you have someone?" She was interrupted for a second time, but this time not by Kai. A balding, pot-bellied traveler in the red robes of Naraka came jogging up, waving for her attention. Only at that point did Kai realize the man had only one hand. The aging traveler began to speak, but as he did, a wail like a thousand furious ghosts pierced the palace. Adrienne clapped her hands to her ears, but Kai reached into his pocket. He had always wished Valenhal had a power to dull the senses instead of enhancing them. The ring of one dragon's fang upon another made quite an ear-shattering noise. Since the territory had no such power, though, at least none so far as Kai knew, he had taken to bringing globs of soft wax with him to battle. He pulled two pieces off and stuffed them into his ears. Immediately, the piercing shriek was cut to nothing more than a distant scream. Lady Adrienne shouted something at him, which he couldn't understand, but he gave her a placid smile and nodded. She rolled her eyes and pointed him into a room, so he nodded again and followed her instructions. A group of other travelers followed him, but he waved them back. When they failed to understand, he shouted at them to fall back. At last, an exasperated Lady Adrienne brought them out of the room and sealed the door. The situation was fairly transparent. Obviously, the Grandmasters had decided to send an attack early, and somehow Adrienne's scouts had managed to detect the assault. For Kai, that simplified the situation greatly. He would stay in this room and wait. If travelers showed up here, he would kill them. If they did not, he would continue waiting until ordered elsewhere. Simplicity itself. The route to Bel-Kalem through Naraka would be too well guarded, Grandmaster Naraka told Alan. The defenses for that waypoint would have stood for years, solid and all but impenetrable. There would be traps, tricks, guardians, and fortifications too thick for them to penetrate. So they came through a different territory. There were 23 of them, Galad, Grandmaster Naraka, Alan, and 20 soldiers of Enosh, to deal with the more mundane threats. Alan had heard that there was a squad of 3 or 4 Tartarus travelers with the soldiers, but he couldn't tell the difference. Maybe most of the troops couldn't either. Galad was one of the few in Enosh with a link to 2 territories, and he could draw from either Naraka or Helgard with equal ease. At Grandmaster Naraka's insistence, he opened up a gate to Helgard, and they walked through its snowy depths. That was when Alan learned something that no one had bothered to mention about Helgard, the Tower of Winter. The place was cold. Sure, he had expected to run across flat plains of glacial ice, and the razor-edged chill in the air didn't surprise him. But plate armor, it turned out, was not the best thing to wear in such temperatures. It burned his skin as though he wore a suit of solid ice, and he hurried through as much to keep himself from freezing to death as he did to reach their destination that much sooner. They had emerged from the gate with their backs to a colossal wall. It was made of some blue-gray material that looked like metal, etched with gigantic symbols. Each twisting letter stood higher than Alan was tall. The wall curved around so slightly that Alan barely noticed it was curving at all, and it vanished into the distance in both directions. Galad said that was the outer wall of the tower. Alan looked up and saw, an impossibly high distance overhead, a metal ceiling, the same color as the walls. It was covered with icicles the size of stalactites. Wisps of cloud twisted in and among the ice like lacy ribbons. Sure enough, they were inside some kind of enclosure, though one so big that it had its own horizon. Galad called this the 16th floor, telling Alan that 32 floors of Helgard had been discovered so far. This one was one of the least inhabited, comprised as it was of seemingly endless fields of ice. The ice seemed to glow with an inner radiance, giving the room a surprisingly bright illumination. According to Galad, there were creatures and artifacts hiding in the cracks of ice, and they did not like to be disturbed. As long as they kept their voices down and hurried across, they should be able to reach their way into Bel-Kalem with little trouble. "Why don't they have any guardians on this side?" Alan whispered, trying to step as lightly as possible in his clanking armor.
It's all but impossible to defend your home from every possible approach in every territory,
Grandmaster Naraka said. She seemed to practically glide over the slick, uneven footing, as though she had no weight at all.
That's true, Galad allowed. But it's also unwise to bring a very large force through this floor. More people means more noise, and if you get too loud, well, you don't want to do that.
The first three expeditions to this floor vanished entirely, and the fourth came back wrong. The glow in the ice underneath their feet flickered, as though something unimaginably huge had, for just a moment, passed in front of the light. Alan spent the rest of the trip with his mouth shut. He barely even allowed himself to breathe. The soldiers had worn light armor, and not one of them had said a word since passing through the gate, which showed how much wiser they were than he. Galad finally reached his landmark, a frozen hand and forearm, outstretched from the ice like a dying man reaching out of the water for salvation. The wrist was easily as wide as Alan's body, and the tips of the fingers reached well above Alan's head.
"What was this?" Alan asked quietly, indicating the frozen hand.
"Not was," Galad said. "Is. Now, hold on a minute, if you don't mind. I need to concentrate."
That was as forceful as Alan had ever heard the other traveler, so he stayed quiet. Galad muttered constantly to himself, as though reciting some long poem in a foreign language. Finally, he motioned as though pulling aside a curtain, and a gate opened behind his fingers.
"We have to be quick," Grandmaster Naraka whispered.
At a whispered signal from a woman in front who looked like the leader, all 20 soldiers began marching through. The other side of the gate opened up on a broad room that looked a great deal like Malachi's Great Hall, which Alan had visited a month before. It wasn't the same room, simply one built along the same lines. This room was smaller, although still spacious, and it hosted a few necessities, like wash basins and hat racks, instead of Malachi's blocky throne. Alan wasn't sure what this room was supposed to be used for, and he had no idea where the hanging tree would be located from here. But at least there were no enemy troops around, and that was all he cared about. The soldiers spread out across Malachi's room, forming a protective shield between the travelers and whatever unknown forces might be protecting the Overlord's home. Grandmaster Naraka flipped her hand negligently to one side, and 5 red sparks shot out from the air in front of her. They flew in loops around the room, flashing in and out of visibility like blood-red fireflies. Galad started looking from wall to wall, muttering to himself. Frost began to form on the ground at his feet, but Alan couldn't see any other visible indication of his actions.
"I don't sense anything," Galad said eventually. "Did they really not have any guardians in this room?"
"Nor do I," Grandmaster Naraka agreed. "I also sense no alarms, but I spotted something that might once have been a nest of Kartul."
"They would be screaming right now," Galad said. "We'd all hear it."
Alan continued turning, examining the room. There was barely enough ambient light to see, coming from the Grandmaster's fireflies and the windows set high on the walls. The vast majority of the room, however, remained in shadow.
"Maybe they didn't set an alarm," Alan suggested.
"Or maybe," the Grandmaster said, "the alarm has already been silenced."
Galad shook his head.
"I wouldn't think so, Grandmaster. They would have to have detected us in Helgard, and there are no long-term installations on the 16th floor, so to have an alarm there..."
"That means they would have known we were coming," the Grandmaster concluded.
Alan felt a chill that had nothing to do with the lingering cold from Helgard. A deafening clatter of wood and metal caught Alan's attention. He spun on his heel to see that one of the Enosh soldiers had crumpled in a heap. Blood spread from under his helm.
"Form up!" someone yelled, and the soldiers' ring around the 3 travelers became even tighter.
When they drew together, though, one of the squad didn't move. He stood there, with his back to Alan, as though staring into the shadow.
"Come on," Alan called,
but Grandmaster Naraka seized his arm.
"Quiet, boy," she hissed.
"Why?" Alan wondered,
but he kept the thought to himself. He's just standing there. Then the soldier collapsed to his knees and fell over onto his side. Blood leaked from his armor. Somewhere in the room, someone began to sing. Hush, my child, night is coming. The waking world grows dull and gray. Someone behind Alan shouted, and there was a clang like two swords clashing. He turned, summoning a globe of golden force into his hand. Whoever this attacker was, he was about to face the power of Elysia. Two soldiers lay on the ground, both of their drawn swords in pieces. The voice continued in a haunting sing-song lullaby. Leave your fear and leave your pain. I will make it go away.
Enough of this foolishness, Grandmaster Naraka growled. She raised her hands, winced as though experiencing a minor and irritating pain, flicking her fingers up toward the roof.
More of those red fireflies darted from her hands, but these hovered in glowing clouds at the corners of the ceiling. The resulting light was dim and bloody, but more than enough for Alan to see. What he saw was a dim, swift figure in black darting from shadow to shadow. Alan pulled his arm back and hurled the globe of Elysian light at the shadowed figure. The silhouette of a man didn't dodge or run out of the way. He raised one arm, and a golden blast struck him below the elbow. Alan's light struck a shield of translucent green force. It was literally a shield, diamond-shaped, and etched with a design that Alan couldn't quite make out. But it seemed to be outlined in semi-transparent planes of phantom light. The golden blast crashed against that pale green shield and did nothing. The shield flickered and disappeared, leaving the room as dark as before. Galad took advantage of the moment to step forward, rolling his marked hand in a complex pattern that Alan had last seen from Overlord Malachi. A bright orange fireball, seemingly made out of screaming faces, appeared from Galad's hand, streaking straight for the silhouette. This time, the man in shadows didn't even bother to raise his arm. The fire crashed against his chest, splashing harmlessly against a ghostly green breastplate that the man had not been wearing earlier. It was as though the man was covered in a full suit of armor that was completely invisible until it was needed. Was there anything they could do to get through to him? Grandmaster Naraka, Alan noticed, had been moving both hands in a complex pattern for some time now. She finally finished, shouldered two soldiers apart to make room, and thrust her hands out toward the man in shadows. She made a sound like a grunt, as though she had repressed a scream, and a scaly red claw, the size of Alan's midsection, pushed itself out from midair and crunched on the tiles, its claws scraping up a handful of the floor. Ah, the figure in black said. At last. The creature continued to pull itself into the world, revealing an enormous shoulder covered in spikes and ridges of hardened plate. Alan was almost afraid to see what would come through.
Bear witness, Grandmaster Naraka screamed. For the first time in 1,000 years, this world shall tremble before...
She was cut off by the single, clear, crystal note of a horn. It reverberated through the entire room, echoing and crashing in Alan's ears, somehow without sounding strident or unpleasant. The arm froze at the sound. It trembled, as though stuck between worlds. After the note had gone on for only a second, the hand was slurped back through the gate. The portal winked out, leaving the room in silence. The figure in black lowered a horn from his lips. It was seemingly made out of glass, and it had some kind of transparent tube in the middle that swirled with water. How did glass and water produce a sound like a horn? The man in the shadows shrugged.
I'm sorry, he said. Were you not done?
Alan gave some serious thought to retreating. Someone screamed an order, and the soldiers rushed forward. Five men led the way, spears leveled. Three, to Alan's surprise, stayed back with him and the other two travelers. The remainder of the troops rushed after the spearmen, swords drawn. The figure in black waited until the spears were almost upon him, before he reached to the side and summoned a sword. It was long and straight, not the slightly curving sword that Simon used.
I knew it, Grandmaster Naraka hissed. Valenhal.
A Valenhal traveler, Alan thought. This man looked very different from Simon. For one thing, though the swordsman was wearing all black, they were simply dark clothes, not the billowing black cloak that Simon tended to wear. Also, Alan couldn't imagine Simon fighting without summoning that ridiculously long sword of his. Plus, Alan didn't see any dolls. He wasn't exactly sure if the little girl's dolls he had seen Simon carrying had anything to do with Valenhal, but he had chosen to assume that they did. Simon carried a doll everywhere now, so either they had something to do with Simon's territory, or he had developed a disturbing habit. Either way, Alan saw none of the hallmarks that he had associated with Simon and Valenhal. But Grandmaster Naraka seemed certain, and she would know better than he would. The five spearmen died very quickly. The man in black grabbed one of the spears below the head, pulling that soldier off balance and skewering him on the tip of a sword. He stepped forward, inside the reach of two other spearmen, and then he was holding two swords, one in each hand. He struck out to either side, slicing through the spearmen's necks as though they weren't even wearing armor. The rest grabbed one of the spears below the head, pulling that soldier off balance and skewering him on the tip of a sword. He stepped forward, inside the reach of two other spearmen, and then he was holding two swords, one in each hand. He struck out to either side, slicing through the spearmen's necks as though they weren't even wearing armor. The remaining two soldiers with spears leveled their weapons, thrusting them at the man. He cut one in half and spun around the other, drawing his sword across the soldier's throat. The last soldier threw down his half of a spear, screaming, and ran away. The swordsman in black cocked his head to one side, but watched his enemy run. By this time, the Enosh soldiers with swords had stopped their run and come to a complete halt, hesitating before stepping into arm's reach of the killer in black. "Fall back!" one of the soldiers next to Alan shouted. She had a voice made to cut through deafening battlefields, and Alan realized she must be the commander. "We'll handle the traveler," she said. She stepped forward, and the other two soldiers that had stayed with Alan stepped forward at the same time. These must be the Tartarus travelers, Alan realized. Since coming to Enosh, he had heard of Tartarus travelers referred to as soldiers, but he had never thought of them as fighting shoulder to shoulder with ordinary troops. Travelers had, to him, always seemed like they should be kept separate from the ordinary fighters. The five swordsmen seemed only too happy to fall back, hurrying back to the travelers with more enthusiasm than discipline. The man in black simply stood there and watched, head cocked to one side. As one, the three Tartarus travelers each pulled out a small silver object and pointed them toward the man in black. They would be keys, Alan knew, tiny keys of Tartarus steel the travelers of that territory used in summoning. Each traveler moved the key differently. One turned it, as though opening a lock. One drew the key from top to bottom, like slitting a curtain down the middle. The other drew her key from left to right. A Tartarus gate gaped open in front of each traveler, and wind whipped in the red-lit room as though the gates were sucking all the air in with them. A spinning blade, like a razor-edged cartwheel, flew out of one gate, flying parallel to the ground. Another gate spat forth a spray of arm-length needles. From the third, a huge form, like a man in a suit of silver armor, but impossibly large, shouldered his way into the world. The summoning process took only a split second, which must have been what stopped the man in black from simply blowing his glass horn again and forcing the gates to disappear. Alan wasn't sure he had ever seen a traveler open a gate and complete a summons as quickly as these three from Tartarus. But the swordsman in black was ready. He went to one knee as soon as he saw the Tartarus travelers take out their keys, and he placed both of his swords very carefully on the floor. When the air in front of him exploded in a storm of flashing steel, the man in black summoned an enormous shield that looked as though it had been designed to stop a rampaging bear. It was huge, easily big enough for the crouching man to hide behind, and most of its center was covered by a scuffed bronze plate. The swordsman angled the shield and let the needles slam into it. Most either stuck in the wood or struck the bronze plate, bouncing off and spinning into the air. The bladed wheel spun over the shield, shaving a splinter of wood from the shield's very tip. The swordsman did something. It happened so fast that Alan wasn't sure exactly what he saw, but it seemed as though the man in black thrust his hand up into the center of the spinning blade, grabbing somewhere Alan couldn't see. The silvery disc stopped spinning as the swordsman in black clutched it by the middle. Now that it wasn't moving so quickly, Alan could see the weapon in more detail. It was a solid sheet of metal, razor sharp all the way around, but the center of the circular disc was empty. The circle in the middle was crossed by a single bar, as though to give a warrior something to grip. There was no way to use it as a handhold, though, Alan was sure. Even though the swordsman held it up now, there was no way he could use it. The disc was too wide, too heavy, and too unwieldy to use in combat. He could try and use it like a shield, Alan supposed, but he had a much better shield sitting on the ground in front of him. Besides, the disc had a hole in the middle.
"Oh, no," Galad whispered.
He started muttering to himself in what Alan recognized as the beginnings of a Hellguard summons. The swordsman in black leaped over his shield, running to meet the huge man in silver armor. The armored giant drew an enormous broadsword, swinging with two hands down on the man's head. He blocked the sword with the edge of the silvery disc, and sparks flew. By the light of the sparks, Alan could tell that the swordsman was indeed dressed head to toe in black. He had wrapped strips of black cloth over his face and head. With the disc in the swordsman's left hand, he held off the armor's sword. With his other hand, he slipped his own sword inside the armor's visor. That simple. He almost looked delicate, as though he were simply and harmlessly flicking the man on his metal forehead. The armored man seemed to melt, sinking down to the floor in a deafening clatter of metal. By this time, the three Tartarus travelers had spread out to surround the man in black, already moving their keys to summon more weapons. The five remaining swordsmen spread out as well, presumably to keep from looking useless. And Alan made a decision. The Grandmaster was waving her hand in a summoning motion, probably to make another useless demonstration of power, and Galad was still muttering his Hellguard summons. Alan grabbed them both by the back of the neck and pulled them toward the corner of the room. Galad sputtered and coughed, cut off mid-chant. Grandmaster Naraka tried to grab him by the arm with her glowing red hand, promising vile threats.
"Quiet," Alan said. "We're wasting time."
He wasn't sure he would get away with that tone any other time, but at the moment he was far more focused on getting results. Alan dragged them off to one corner of the room, underneath a cloud of Naraka's red fireflies. He glanced to his side, to the room's door, and briefly considered walking out. He quickly rejected the idea. They could wander the corridors of this house for hours looking for the incarnation. Despite what the Grandmaster claimed, he didn't think it would be so easy to find the way downstairs in the Overlord's mansion.
"What are you doing, boy?"
Grandmaster Naraka demanded.
"We need to get to the incarnation," Alan said.
"Good point," Galad said. "Stay on mission." Grandmaster Naraka shot a poisonous glance back at the Valenhall traveler, but she brushed her hands off, businesslike.
"We've wasted enough time here. Let's get moving."
She sounded for all the world as if leaving had been her idea.
"So where is the room?" Alan asked.
"The hanging tree has to be in contact with the earth," Grandmaster Naraka responded.
Her red glasses looked almost black in the crimson light.
"Wherever it is, it will be below us."
Alan reached out to Elysia, that sunny light he always felt over his shoulder. Bright golden force began to gather between his palms.
"Below it is," Alan said.
He blasted a hole in the floor, and they dropped down.
Chapter 11. Alan versus Kai. Simon stared at the sword jutting from the incarnation's chest. Indiriel barely hung on to the hilt, still kneeling on the ground, too exhausted to stand. But he pushed the sword in with both hands.
I couldn't see you, Valen said thickly.
"It's my impeccable fashion sense," Indiriel responded.
He twisted his blade as he tore it from the incarnation's flesh. Valen stood there a moment, a ragged hole in his chest, and Simon allowed himself to relax. The soldiers were still fighting the Nai, but they seemed to be winning. At least, there were fewer black robes standing than there had been a few minutes before. Maybe this would all soon be over.
Step back, Angeline said grimly. It's not over.
Valen looked up, and for a moment the silver of his eyes gleamed brighter than the moon. A bright green light flared in his wound, like sunlight filtered through a forest canopy. Before Simon's eyes, the incarnation's wound knitted itself whole. The Valenhal incarnation spun, impossibly fast, and seized Indiriel's wrist. Indiriel twisted for leverage, trying to break his master's hold, but Valen's grip didn't budge. The chains on his skin twisted and writhed like a nest of black snakes. With a shout, the incarnation hauled Indiriel off his feet and lifted him up in the air, slamming him down against the ground with a deafening crack. The overlord struggled feebly, but Valen walked up and stomped on his ribs with impossible force. Simon heard the crack from where he crouched in the bushes 2 dozen steps away. Valen kicked his former student, hard enough that Indiriel's body rose into the air. He spun on his heel and kicked Indiriel's black-cloaked form in midair, launching him all the way across the clearing. The body rolled when it landed, coming to a stop almost at Simon's feet.
That's enough, Valen said calmly.
With one hand, he brushed the blood from his chest. The wound was already gone completely. With his other hand, he summoned his blade. Valen swung his gaze to the southeast, staring off into the distance. Simon barely heard his words.
You won't stop me this time, Valen said.
I will smash through anything in my way.
I will earn this.
With a chill, Simon realized Valen was staring in the direction of Kana. The incarnation of Valenhal raised his blade to the sky as if in salute, and for an instant, the Nai all froze. They collapsed into shadows and moonlight essence, slithering away. The soldiers who had been engaged in combat looked around, bewildered, wondering where their opponents had gone. One or two even raised a ragged cheer. Valen dashed forward, faster than Simon had ever moved with Nai essence. Simon couldn't even see him, except in flashes. First, he was on the hill where he had fought Indiriel. Then he was 20 paces away, standing in the middle of the soldiers, his gold and silver sword pulled back. The soldiers died. They fell like wheat at the harvest. One man had a Tartarus steel blade and managed to knock aside one of Valen's blows before the incarnation kicked him across the battlefield and on top of the nearest tent. No one else offered any resistance. Valen passed through the crowd of soldiers and in only a handful of seconds left nothing behind him but bodies and bloody mud. Obviously, one of Indiriel's travelers had survived, because a red lizard, like a blood-red salamander the size of a pony, with 3 barbed tails, ran up and hissed in Valen's direction. It flicked its tail forward, sending 3 tiny fireballs buzzing toward the incarnation's face. He didn't bother blocking. The fireballs shattered in midair, inches from Valen's face, crashing against a translucent helm of pale green light. When the light from the fire faded, so too did the helm. Valen vanished from where he was standing, reappearing 10 paces later behind the giant salamander. The lizard's tails each fell to the ground, followed by its head. Valen kept walking through the camp, due southeast, seemingly in a hurry this time. Every once in a while his sword dipped into one or another of the tents to his side, and he withdrew it, even bloodier than before. Simon shivered as he realized that, this time, the incarnation was going to cut his way through all the way to Kana. What was the village that Indiriel had shown him on the map, the one between them and Kana? The village of Belcor? Angeline interrupted his thoughts.
We need to get Indiriel to the house, she said, her tone firm. Simon, you need to get Indiriel in the pool, or he will die. You can still return to fight the incarnation.
Fight him? Simon asked. I can't stop him. I'm not ready for him.
You don't have to stop him, just to slow him down, remember? Indiriel's reinforcements should be here soon. But for now, return to the house.
Simon wasn't sure there was any need. Indiriel was likely dead already, considering the beating he'd taken. Simon called what little steel he could, Even the small trickle he managed to draw from Valenhall was enough to keep him on his feet, and moved Azura down the air in the beginnings of a Valenhall gate. As soon as the portal was complete, Simon hauled Indiriel through and began dragging him down the hall toward the pool. He would need to toss the Overlord in for healing and stand guard himself, since Indiriel was obviously in no shape to deal with the imps on his own. Simon tried to keep his own condition from his mind, but he couldn't help noticing the aches and pains of his body. He was covered in scrapes, cuts, and bruises. There was no part of his body that didn't ache. He had sustained over a dozen cuts that he didn't remember earning, and his steel would only last him another few seconds before failing entirely. Even worse, he was exhausted at a bone-deep level. He had never felt so tired. But he stayed on his feet, dragging Indiriel down the hall by the neck of his cloak. He had run out of liquid steel completely, and was pulling the Overlord down the hallway with nothing more than the strength in his tired arms, when he backed into something. Wearily, Simon turned to see Lycus catching his balance against the wall. His blonde hair was disheveled, and the side of his face purple, as though he had just come from a fight. Simon didn't have time to ask questions. He shoved Indiriel at the boy. "Lycus, I need you to get some help. Take care of this guy. Bring him to the pool and protect him while he's in there. Can you do that?" Lycus nodded, his eyes wide, and he started to hurry off for help. He had barely moved more than a few feet, though, before he hesitated and turned back to Simon. "Where are you going to be?" he asked. "Doing something stupid," Simon replied, forcing his aching body to limp back toward the gate. Kai was gone, Indiriel unconscious. Somebody had to slow the incarnation down before he carved a bloody trough through the village of Belcor, and it looked like that was going to be him. He tried to convince himself that it wasn't his responsibility, that he could let Indiriel's Damascan friends take care of it whenever they showed up. It didn't work. Simon wasn't sure if he could stop Valen long enough for reinforcements to show up. He didn't know if Indiriel's reinforcements could handle an incarnation, even if they did show up in time. But he did know that he couldn't sit around and do nothing. He had to try. Alan stood three floors below where he had started, crouching behind the green shield he'd summoned from Elysia. The shield surrounded him in a half-dome made of hexagonal plates of interlocking green light, like a honeycomb of solid force. A bolt of lightning shattered against the green shield without even scorching the travelers within. Galad and Grandmaster Naraka stood behind him, but he couldn't turn to check on their condition. Every once in a while he felt a flash of heat on his back and heard a somewhat distant scream, and he took that to mean they were doing their jobs. So he had to focus on his own. There were two Indros travelers in front of him, a man and a woman, and their storms were growing big enough to shroud the entire hallway in black clouds and flashing lightning. Alan had learned enough of Indros to know that, the bigger those gates became, the more he had to worry about. Defending himself from lightning bolts was worry enough for anyone. Alan let the green shield flicker out of existence to hurl a head-sized globe of golden light. But he had to pull the shield back up when one of the travelers tried to swarm him with a flock of little flying lizards. They scrabbled against his green shield, hissing at him and crackling with blue sparks. "Send me another one of those lights," the female traveler taunted. "That was delicious." "Come on out and fight," the male called. Alan didn't know what was worse, the fact that they considered it an actual battlefield tactic to try and taunt him into making a stupid decision, or the fact that it was almost working. He was all but prepared to drop his shield and run at them with his fists if he thought that would shut him up. There was a flash of heat against his back, and then a freezing chill. Something huge roared, and, though Alan didn't turn around, he would have bet it had a mouth full of razor-sharp teeth. The whole floor thundered as the whatever it was pounded down the hallway toward its prey. Grandmaster Naraka tapped him on the shoulder.
"Allow me to tend to these two, Eliadel. I have some experience with Indros."
Alan stepped to one side, though he didn't let his green shield lapse. The Grandmaster made a few gestures with her hand, and a head poked its way out of thin air in front of her. It looked like a jet-black crocodile's head on a long, serpentine neck. As it got closer to his shield, the head burst into flames.
"I've seen one of those things before," Alan realized aloud. "I fought one in Belcalum.
They are the Kushradosh,
Grandmaster Naraka explained, taking on a lecturing tone.
Also known as snapdragons. They are quite rare and prefer to attack from ambush. Drop the shield, please.
Alan glanced at her. The swarm of flying lizards was still only feet away, gnawing at the solid green light as though wishing to tear flesh from bone. At his look, Grandmaster Naraka nodded, so Alan let the shield drop. Immediately, the tiny flyers rushed toward Naraka's black lizard.
Little known facts about the Kushradosh, the Grandmaster said. First, Endros creatures almost always consider it the strongest creature around, so they attack it first.
The giant black creature had fully emerged from the gate now, and it seemed to be having a great time snapping the little drakes out of the air and swallowing them whole. Their blue sparks seemed to cause it no inconvenience whatsoever.
Second, the Grandmaster continued, snapdragons do not mind lightning.
The hallway filled with a blinding light, and Alan flinched away from the radiance. His hair stood on end, and the whole hall smelled as though the air was somehow burned. One or both of the Endros travelers had launched a bolt of lightning at him, but it had been intercepted by the snapdragon's black hide. It swiveled its crocodile head toward the Endros pair and let out a deafening roar, bursting fully into flame at the same time. When it waddled down the hallway, it did so with frightening, sinuous speed. Alan raised his arm to protect himself from the snapdragon's heat, but Grandmaster Naraka, who had been standing even closer to the burning creature than Alan, seemed to feel no need. She watched her summoned creature, impassive behind her red spectacles. The Kushradosh had reached the two Endros travelers now, having slipped between their rolling thunderstorms. The woman had banished her storm, fighting the monster hand to hand with her drawn sword. She was laughing for some reason. The man kept maneuvering his storm like a shield, so that every time the snapdragon bit at him, it risked falling into the storm. They had, however temporarily, taken their eyes off the other three travelers. Perhaps they expected their allies at the other end of the hallway to distract Alan and his party long enough for them to survive. Galad walked up to stand shoulder to shoulder with Alan. "All finished," he said. Alan didn't have to check to know that everyone else in the room was dead.
"So it's just these two," Alan said.
Grandmaster Naraka nodded, and Alan filled both of his palms with golden light. The male traveler managed to get his gait up in time, swallowing the golden light whole, and the woman somehow sensed the light coming, spun around, and caught the blast on the flat end of her sword. The light deflected up into the ceiling, sending debris clattering down.
"Wow," Galad said. "That was impressive."
As soon as the Endros travelers turned to deal with Alan's attack, the snapdragon tore into them from behind, fire and claws and fanged jaws working in unison. Alan winced, looking away, as the smell of burning flesh filled the hall. It was nauseating, and he could feel bile rising in his throat.
"I will not lose control," he thought. "Not in front of them. I will not allow myself to look weak."
Grandmaster Naraka and Galad walked forward, stepping over the burnt corpses of the Endros travelers as though picking their way through so much garbage. Alan followed on their heels, trying to stare at anything else. Past the bodies of the two Endros travelers, the hall ended in a pair of stone doors, carved with forbidding designs that looked like they might crawl right off. Grandmaster Naraka put her red-marked right hand forward and straightened her spine visibly.
"This is it," she whispered. "After all these years, I can hear Naraka itself crying behind these doors."
Galad stepped forward as though he couldn't help himself, like something in the room beyond was drawing him. He placed both hands on the doors, feeling around.
"I don't sense any traps, at least nothing I can detect. Just a chain and a padlock."
Grandmaster Naraka snorted.
"Out of the way, boy. I'll show you how to check for traps."
She walked forward and began waving her hand in an orderly pattern, her face set in a stony expression, as though she were preparing to endure a blow. Alan should have felt triumphant, standing as they were in front of their goal, but for some reason he felt nervous. They had certainly worked hard enough to earn their way here, and the reason they had decided to strike here in the first place was because they knew it was lightly defended. But something twisted in his gut, as though his body itself were certain something was wrong. He looked up and down the hallway, seeing nothing but corpses and destruction left by their battle.
"We've won," Alan told himself. "I need to celebrate, not take everything so seriously. I'm not Simon."
For some reason, though, he couldn't feel anything but exhaustion. Alan turned back to Grandmaster Naraka, who had a hand to the door. The cracks between shone with a bright red light. He almost didn't hear the light thump that sounded from the other end of the hallway, but that sound sent shivers down his spine in a way that the roar of battle never had. Alan spun around to face the noise, hurling a globe of destructive golden light in the same motion. It was the swordsman in black from earlier. He had hopped through the hole Alan had blasted down to this floor, which meant he must have followed them down the other floors, too. His head was no longer wrapped in black cloth, and his hair was a white mop that hung down into his eyes. He crouched there, knees bent, one hand pressed against the tile, until Alan's blast of gold almost reached him. He cocked his head to one side, and the ball of golden energy flew over his shoulder and crashed into the wall behind him.
"Dangerous, dangerous," the white-haired swordsman said casually. "You should find new toys to play with."
Then he was running down the hall, and Alan began to wonder if they would make it out of here alive. Alan put both hands forward, filling the hall with his bright green honeycomb shield. It would take the swordsman a few minutes at least to get through the plane of solid light, and by then Grandmaster Naraka would be inside the doors. The Grandmaster cackled.
"Well done, Eliadel. Stall him until I can get through."
The swordsman raised one hand, placing it flat against the translucent green wall, opposite Alan's own hands on the other side. From this close, Alan saw that the white-haired man's arm was wrapped in the same black chain marks as Simon's. Maybe they had something to do with summoning, somehow, like the symbol Naraka travelers had tattooed on their hands.
"You fought bravely," Alan called. "Now stand aside and let us finish our mission. Do not stand with Damaska. They..."
The chains on the man's arms went from black to a bright, flaring white in an instant, and Alan's shield shattered like glass. The pain was indescribable, as though someone had torn out a piece of Alan's skull and crushed it underfoot. He screamed, collapsing to his knees, barely noticing that he had landed in a pool of blood. The Valenhall traveler walked casually past Alan. As he did, the swordsman pulled something out of one ear.
"Wax?" "I couldn't hear you," the man sang.
He didn't bother to cut Alan down, but Alan was in too much pain to wonder why. Alan watched through a haze of agony as Galad raised both hands, chanting and spinning his Naraka-marked hand at the same time. Behind him, Grandmaster Naraka was pulling the doors open. The white-haired man stepped forward, and, though he didn't move any faster than before, Alan somehow lost track of his movements. He moved so smoothly that Alan could barely see him step from one place to another. He stepped past Galad, slipping a foot behind the young traveler's ankle and tripping him to the ground. While Galad still hung in midair, the swordsman slammed his fist into the young man's face. Galad crashed into the floor, and the Valenhall man kept walking. Grandmaster Naraka had the doors fully open now, and she was waving her red-marked hand desperately, trying to summon enough power to incinerate the hanging tree. A huge, broad-bladed knife flashed into the Valenhall traveler's hand. He stepped forward, and the steel flashed twice. The Grandmaster's hands fell to the ground. She grunted but didn't scream, running forward into the room as though there was something she could still do to accomplish their mission. The Valenhall traveler grabbed her by the scruff of the neck, like an unruly puppy, and pulled her back.
"No, no, no," the white-haired man said. "We must all wait our turn."
He raised the knife high. Alan rushed forward, leaping to his feet despite the pain, to try and save Grandmaster Naraka.
"The tree, Alan," Naraka screamed desperately. "Get the tree."
The world seemed to freeze as Alan's mind tore in two different directions, trying to come to some sort of decision.
He could reach their goal right now. All he had to do was throw himself to the right, through the doors, and unload golden power into the tree. Out of the corner of his eye, he could even see his target, a mass of blood-red vines, leaves, and branches that covered the entire basement room. Then again, he would be leaving Grandmaster Naraka and Galad to die. Alan would likely survive, since he could still open a gate and retreat to his territory. The other two were in no shape to do so. Galad was unconscious, the Grandmaster crippled. Even worse, he wasn't sure he wanted to destroy the tree. What would happen if he released an incarnation here? The plan had been to withdraw through Naraka, where the Naraka incarnation couldn't enter. But now that he had to travel Elysia, who was to say that the incarnation couldn't follow him there? The white-haired Valenhal traveler cocked his head to one side, like a curious bird.
Alan, he said.
Alan made his decision. He filled the hall with golden power, blasting the swordsman with pure force. The man in black tried to swat the golden blast away with the blade of his knife, but he was ultimately thrown backwards, past the doors and down the hall. Alan didn't follow him, throwing up a green shield again to delay the man. If the Valenhal traveler managed to shatter this one, too, Alan thought he might pass out from the pain. But he needed something to stall the man, even for a few seconds. He slipped one gold-plated arm under Naraka's midsection, pulling her back to crouch over Galad. Opening a gate usually took him almost a minute, but he didn't even have 5 seconds. He needed the gate open now. He poured his desperation, his focus, and his remaining energy into the air in front of him, willing it to tear open and show him Elysia. At last, the gate peeled open, revealing the City of Light. The sky of the territory seemed made of pure gold, as though the entire realm had been locked into an eternal sunrise. The city gleamed under the golden light, its walls stretching off as far as Alan could see in either direction. The walls were vast and white, probably 50 paces high at their peak, and adorned with flowing designs and precious gems. The gates of the city were silver and gold, boasting even more jewels. The city stood even higher than the walls, revealing peaked towers of gold, copper, bronze, and other, more exotic materials. The shining green leaves of an impossibly tall tree waved next to one particular tower, and the tree's fruits glimmered like half-seen stars. Outside the wall stretched a field, the flowers and grasses blowing gently in a spring-scented breeze. This seemed like a place of safety, where one could relax and enjoy the surroundings. Usually. At the moment, it felt like their last, desperate hope. Alan's power ripped out of him with the gate, leaving him dangerously exhausted. Even his vision fuzzed for a moment, and he wasn't sure if he would be able to move through the portal. Under his arm, Grandmaster Naraka thrashed weakly.
"No, Alan, no," she said. "The tree, Alan. Get the tree."
She had done something to the stumps where her hands used to be. They were mangled and torn and looked half-burnt, but they didn't bleed as much as they should have. Still, she left a trickle of blood on the tiles.
"It's not worth it," Alan said.
He placed Grandmaster Naraka beyond the gate, onto the softly waving grass. He grabbed Galad by the legs and dragged him through. The ground on the other side wasn't exactly parallel with the floor, and Galad may have dropped a few inches when Alan dragged him through, but a few bruises on Galad's head was the last thing Alan wanted to worry about at this point. Alan saw the Valenhal traveler raising one chain-marked arm and pressing it against the green wall, and he hurriedly let the gate vanish. He had learned over the past weeks that any shields he left behind would disappear as soon as he stepped into another territory.
"Ralia," Alan called.
He wanted nothing more than to relax down into the mattress softness of the grassy Elysian fields, but he was afraid Grandmaster Naraka would soon bleed to death. She was still shaking her head from side to side, panting and begging Alan to go back, but her voice was barely audible. She looked as though she was only a few seconds from passing out. Ralia would know what to do, though. She was his guide to the City of Light, and she would know something to help his allies. He started to call her name again, but he saw something that made his heart freeze. In the air behind him, where the gate had once been, a hand was sticking out of midair.
This hand was covered in a black gauntlet, a gauntlet with pointed, almost clawed fingertips. And as Alan watched, it flexed and began to tear the air aside. The outline of the gate burned gold, sending off flares of light as the world resisted being violated from the outside. But finally, the gate crawler finished its work, taking the gate Alan had closed and tearing it wide open. The white-haired swordsman stepped through the gate. He raised his black-gauntleted left hand, shaking one finger as if to berate a naughty child. He said, in a haunting sing-song voice. The little mice don't get to hide in their burrow, do they? Not when they have scratched a lion's nose.
Rolya! Alan called. He scrambled to his feet, hurling another ball of golden light at the Valenhall traveler. It shattered against that translucent green armor, doing no harm whatsoever.
You are in my territory now, intruder, Alan said formally.
He drew himself up to his full height, filling both hands with light, letting his golden armor gleam in Elysia's eternal sunrise.
Your powers cannot stand against mine, not here.
His voice shook a little on the last word, but it was worth taking the chance. The swordsman had successfully defended the tree and thus accomplished his goal. If Alan could get him to leave on his own, the three of them might actually survive.
Can they not?
The Valenhall traveler said curiously. He let his knife drop, and it shimmered and vanished before it hit the grass.
Odd. I don't feel any weaker.
A broad, straight sword flashed into his hand, and he dashed forward. Alan sent out a mental distress call. There were dozens of beings he could summon here, and most of them would not hesitate to lay down their lives for his. The gold ball of light and the green shield were not his only powers, just the ones he could call most easily and most quickly. There were others, though. For instance, he concentrated, visualizing the golden sword that he had summoned before. This, too, was made of interlocking planes of light, but where his shield was made of green, this blade was built of golden force. Light streamed into his hand from all around him, gathering and coalescing into the ghost of a golden blade. Alan brought the sword up in both hands to meet the other traveler's one-handed strike. But the swordsman was strong. Both of Alan's arms trembled from the effort of holding off the Valenhall traveler's blow. His entire body trembled, and he actually had to sink to one knee to avoid collapsing. Even the gold planes of his sword cracked, leaking light like blood.
Not bad, golden man, the white-haired swordsman said.
He didn't appear to be trying particularly hard. Alan noticed marks on the man's arms, like links from a chain of shadows, peeking up from his collarbone. Did the shadow chain spread over his body? Did they make him stronger or weaker? If Alan survived this, he was going to wring some answers out of Simon. The Valenhall traveler kicked Alan in the chest, sending him sprawling in the grass.
That's a nice sword, he said.
Alan barely managed to swing the sword enough to deflect the swordsman's next attack, knocking it aside from his position lying on his back.
They should have taught you how to use it, the swordsman said, shaking his head regretfully.
A woman's voice, cheerful and vibrant, spoke from behind Alan.
We haven't had long to work with him, Rolya said. Give it time.
Alan pushed his head back, looking up at Rolya. She appeared to be a young woman, only a few years older than Alan, if that. Her eyes and her long, flowing hair were gold, not yellow, not the color of straw, but a gleaming metallic gold. She wore a long white dress with a golden sash, and she hovered at least 6 inches off the ground. Alan had never actually seen her stand on a solid floor. Privately, he sometimes wondered if she was even real. She smiled down at him, gold eyes flashing.
Hello, Alan. It seems that every time I see you, you're lying on the grass.
It's so comfortable here, I can't help myself.
His relief at seeing her was so great that he almost laughed. The white-haired Valenhall traveler had ignored Alan as soon as Rolya arrived, instead stepping over to Grandmaster Naraka. He held his sword reversed in both hands, about to drive it down into her chest. Interlocking emerald bracelets appeared around his wrists, locking his hands in place.
Don't challenge me, traveler, Rolya said.
She didn't sound threatening. She sounded as though she were chiding a child. I may not use many powers in the outside world, but here I can manage a few tricks. The swordsman's chains flared white, and the bracelets shattered. So, it seems, can I, he said. He stepped forward, swinging his sword at Ralya's midsection in a gleaming arc. The sword burned with a brief violet light and disappeared mid-swing. We hope you've enjoyed your stay in Elysia, City of Light, she said cheerfully. Please have a wonderful afternoon. Goodbye. The Valenhal traveler stepped forward, reaching for her, as though to attack with his bare hands. There was a flash of blinding orange light, and he was lifted off his feet, carried on a cushion of orange back, and through the still-open gate. From top to bottom, the portal zipped itself shut. Wow, Alan found himself saying. When can I learn to do that? How loyal are you feeling today? Ralya asked, smiling. You would have to demonstrate exceptional loyalty for me to trust you with this. Exceptional loyalty? He had saved two of his teammates today. Surely that should count for something. Oh, right, he thought. My teammates. The Grandmaster, Alan said, sitting up. She needs help. Is there a healer or something? Ralya drifted over to hover above Grandmaster Naraka. Her white dress fluttered in the gentle breeze, and for a moment her golden gaze looked almost calculating, cold, as though she were trying to determine what this woman's life was worth. At last Ralya shook her head, like a child shaking off a nightmare. She snapped her fingers, and a bed of orange lights appeared under Grandmaster Naraka's back, lifting her into the air until she drifted behind Ralya. I'll see what I can do, Ralya said. Alan followed, his body feeling completely drained. He had summoned too much from his territory today, and opened the gate too quickly. He felt as though he would pitch onto his face any second. It didn't help that he was still locked in this heavy golden armor. Ralya flew up to the tall gates of Elysia, which slid open on soundless hinges as she approached. Alan had walked in and out of the city dozens of times, and he still couldn't help but feel a sense of apprehension. Usually, the dangers of Elysia waited deep inside the city, but the first time he had tried to enter, he was almost impaled by dozens of arrows as soon as he pushed open these gates. The entrance this time was harmless enough. It was a curving white stone tunnel, burrowing through the walls, set with blazing golden torches every few paces. Alan walked after the Grandmaster's floating body, her shoes at the same level as his chest. He spared one glance for Galad, still lying unconscious on the grass outside, before deciding to leave him. He didn't have the strength to carry the man, and besides, Galad was still breathing. He would probably be just as safe lying outside the city walls. As Alan followed Ralya and the Grandmaster's drifting bed of light, he turned his head at a sound echoing through the tunnel. It sounded like teacups clattering together on a tray. He glanced ahead, around him, and behind, trying to spot the source of the noise. It could mean danger. In fact, the way his day was going, it was almost certainly something dangerous. Finally, he looked down to see his hand trembling so violently that the plates of his gauntlet shook. Was he that panicked? He hadn't realized. But fear and relief still coursed so violently through his body that he could scarcely stand. Alan clenched his gauntlet into a fist. He couldn't be weak. Not now. He couldn't afford it. Chapter 12. A Declaration of War. Simon dashed away from the clearing, following the trail of the Incarnation. He should have been running across wet grass, but his shoes pounded on hardwood flooring. That was a bad sign. The Incarnation's corruption was spreading. The Damascans' entire camp had been corrupted by the Incarnation's presence now. The tents had changed from peaked canvas into wooden structures with shingled roofs. They looked like dog houses. The earth between the rows of tents had transformed into a wood-paneled floor, the grass into green carpeting. Lantern poles and hitching posts for the horses had turned into coat racks and hat stands. The weapons strewn about camp remained untouched, waiting in barrels or beside cots, but the blood and corpses were nowhere to be seen. Looks like the Nye have been busy, Simon thought. Up ahead, Angeline sent. He still couldn't get used to having a doll who actually kept her mind on business. He wasn't sure he liked it. Kayla or Otoku would have responded with a joke, or at least sarcasm. It usually annoyed him, but now he was finding that he missed their banter. Simon snagged a spear from where it stood upright in a barrel, hefting it in one hand. The incarnation had already destroyed Harrenfell, but Simon could see another village to the southeast. In the distance, he could barely make out Valen's chain-marked back. He was headed straight for the cluster of buildings. As the incarnation walked, the ground behind him turned to polished wood. Rocks scraped and rumbled and shed dust as they shaped themselves into chairs, while trees dropped their leaves and bark as they were formed into carved beams, holding up a ceiling that didn't exist. The world shaped itself around the wanderer, steadily becoming more and more like Valenhall. Simon ran. His steel had almost recovered, and he desperately wanted to call its power. His already exhausted arms ached from supporting the spear, and the muscles in his legs burned. He would need the full extent of his power, so he waited, running on his body's natural strength alone. He was running downhill, and if the terrain had remained in its natural state, he would have had to slow down or risk twisting an ankle on rock and tumbling down. But the incarnation had kindly provided him with an even platform of flat wood, so he ran without hesitation, steadily eating up Valen's lead. The Valenhall incarnation didn't seem to be hurrying, but nor was he wasting time. He moved ahead at a measured pace. Once Simon had covered enough of the distance between him and Valen, he called Steel. The surge of cold power through his body soothed his aching muscles and filled him with a strength that felt intoxicating compared to his exhausted weakness. He hurled the spear with the strength of 5 men, sending it flying more than far enough to take Valen through the back. Simon had never trained with the spear, and aiming one correctly was harder than it looked. The spear clattered to the ground 5 paces ahead and 10 steps to the left of his target. Kayla or Otoku would have made a joke. Even Lilia would have said something to make him feel bad about the throw. Angeline sighed. The incarnation stopped and turned, his black and silver eyes locked onto Simon. He didn't smile or make jokes this time, so maybe he had finally decided to take Simon seriously.
"Azura," Angeline said, and Simon summoned his dragon's fang just as the wanderer summoned his.
Valen stepped forward and seemed to blur. He started out 30 paces away and then stood less than 15 feet in front of Simon, his huge blade drawn back for a thrust. But he froze, staring over Simon's shoulder. Something happened that Simon had never seen before. An oval of purple light flared on Valen's forehead, a single dot in the middle. It looked as though someone had drawn a third eye out of purple ink in the center of Valen's head, and that symbol was now glowing.
"Excuse me a moment, young dragon," Valen said. He straightened up, levering his golden-silver blade to rest on his shoulder. If Simon had thought it would do any good, he would have attacked when the incarnation was off his guard. But his job here was to stall until Indiriel's reinforcements arrived, not to win. The longer Valen stood where he was, the better. Maybe he would even give Simon enough time to restore his Nye essence.
"Besides," Angeline said, "attacking him when he's just standing there wouldn't be fair."
Simon couldn't even begin to explain what was wrong with that statement, so he said nothing. A swirling mass of black clouds and flashing lightning, like a thunderstorm tipped onto its side, grew out of thin air to Valen's side. He tilted his body to keep the Indros gate in view, but he did not turn his back.